with a magnetic loop. There will be a lot of comments of magnetic fields and its low noise reception, because noises are electrical and not electromagnetic, and so it's better for a local noisy environment, and all kinds of curious, strange, non-really physics type of comments are made about a magnetic loop. So it deceptively seems to be simple. The design itself is made of just a few bits and pieces, but how they all go together and how to optimize what they do usually requires a better understanding than some people who play around with magnetic loops appreciate, unfortunately.
What's the lowest SWR that you
use with your magnetic loop? Nothing else has renewed my interest in pulling it out of the bag and taking it and playing with it. And as spring is approaching, maybe I'll do that. Feel good. All the best. Thanks for the comments. I'll listen out for anything further. EC2, GSP, EC2, SP2, thank you.
You're welcome, John. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay, I'm doing this because people tripled with you. Not doubled, but tripled. But I heard everything that you said. So I wish you good luck. And do come back later on and tell us whether you found success or failure or what the story is. Again, the design itself does work. There's lots of people who use them. But there are a lot of modes of failure as well. So I hope it isn't a mechanical failure, just propagation and such, and I wish you good luck. There were two people who doubled with you. One I recognized as Rich, one I didn't quite recognize. So let's give the new guy a chance. The person who wasn't Rich, who tried to make a comment, could you try again? Okay, I guess he changed his mind. Rich, what did you want to say?
Just wanted to ask him what the lowest SWR that he achieved with his magnetic loop.
Let me make sure I have it. Yeah, again, it's been years. Probably the last time I pulled it out would have been like 5 or 6 years ago. But I don't remember anything being, of values that would be concerning. I don't think I had no reflection, but, obviously there's a lot of precision to getting the capacitor in the right spot, so maybe sometimes I just accept it and went on with it, I would say better than 2-1, but again, memory fallible, that was a long time ago.
Well, since you have, let me see if I have it. Since you have 90% of the magnetic loop, you might want to take a look at, I sound like a shill for the guy, but I've been corresponding with him, but I don't know him really. rehamradio.com. If you bought a motor and his controller board, you can remotely tune that capacitor on your magnetic loop, and it may be a whole new antenna for you. But first you have to pull it out and see if you want to get back into it again. Anyway, back to net, W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. I think that John is going to see if it works manually before he tries to automate it. If it doesn't work manually, it's not going to work automated. So you got to walk before you can run.
VHD would have come in.
Sure, Jim.
Very intriguing topic. I those
these magnets caught my eye, and the technology behind them is way advanced for me. I just wanted my first Balun this week, and I did it wrong. So I got a lot to learn on that. But I did learn a little bit about the history of it, and I believe I have it correct that Rommel's army in North Africa, World War II, was very successful using something akin to a magnetic loop antenna and using NVIS propagation on HF. And so there's an interesting history that you can do stuff with it, but I think in some applications it probably doesn't work as well for DX as somebody might wish. It's probably, when it's low, it's probably better for NVIS, I think. The other part is the tuning remote control sounds a bit complex. I would be inclined to try to figure out how to put a gear on the in place of the knob, drive it by a worm gear, and have something akin to a speedometer cable, so you, at a modest distance away, you could just turn it off remotely and get electronics out of the mix. I think this is a middle ground for making these things work. Again, they're above my head, so I'm out on the limb here. Back to that.
Okay, very good. I'm going to have to do some reading. For the most part, one of the nice things about magnetic loops is that they don't have that limitation where if you put them close to the ground, they become a total near vertical incident sky wave. They tend to be much more forgiving of low altitude locations. So I'm sure there's a way to finesse it into near vertical incident sky wave patterns. But they are also capable of a lot of relatively decent DXing. And the efficiencies are not great, but sometimes you don't need all that power to get up into the ionosphere and have it bounce around.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
If you look at World War II pictures, both German and American and British, and you see their jeeps or their vehicles, other types of vehicles, you'll see what looks like a roll cage that's attached to the jeep. They're square, you know, to form the squareness of a jeep, but they're really mag loops, mag loop antennas, and I always wondered what they were. I thought at first they were roll cages in case the jeep tipped over, but they're actually mag loop antennas. And you see it a lot in World War II pictures.
Okay. Again, I'm not quite sure how they're configured to be more near vertical incident skyways. Because most people who've played around with mag loops, they know that there's a null point. If you look through the loop, most people would tend to think that that's the strongest signal, but it's the weakest. The strongest signal is on the right angle to looking through the opening of the loop. And even at that point, the amount of gain of a magnetic loop is very low. It has a gain of 1.5 dBi. That's decibels versus an isotropic kind of light bulb diffuse pattern that's spread out over 360 degrees. So, you know, I'm going to have to read a little bit more of how they turn them into optimally a near vertical incident skyway. There are stories where you can modify the gain by placing counterpoises and such in the design of a magnetic loop, which most magnetic loops don't use, to make it a much more directional and have a higher gain output. So I'll have to take another look at that. Okay, a quick glance at a Google site suggests that if you put it really close to the ground, it can have a near vertical incident type of pattern. Also, keep in mind that under those circumstances, you're going to get more ground coupling, so your efficiencies will be undermined as well. So, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
WY2U with a comment, please, Roy.
Yes, Mike.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding going on about the way the behavior of propagation of these magnetic loops works. You can orient the loop in two planes. You can make it vertically polarized, straight up and down, or horizontal. Let's talk about the near vertical incidence problem that you're discussing. There's nothing significant about the or mystical about the magnetic loop, except it does have one property which makes it different than a dipole. The current around the loop is more or less uniform, so it won't radiate a donut like a dipole. It'll radiate a sphere. Put the loop horizontal close to the ground, and yes, you will have an omnidirectional near vertical incidence antenna, where most of the high energy lobes will occur, let's say, at an angle above 60 degrees. That's for real, and I agree with that, but let me drop a minute. However, if you turn the loop 90 degrees and make it, let's say, vertically polarized, now you have a situation where the loop will radiate better broadside to the loop. In other words, in the plane of the loop, you're going to have not necessarily a null, but a depression in the vertical in the radiation pattern. But the good news is it will radiate in almost every elevation angle from almost the horizon all the way to 90 degrees. So if you orient the antenna vertically, you will have a situation where it's bidirectional, broadside to the loop, but it will act as a very nice radiator for DX, low angle, and high angle. So it depends on how you orient the loop there, Roy. If you orient the loop in the vertical plane, what Rich said before was probably very correct. You can mount it very, very close to the ground, and you'll find out that there's very little interaction between ground and the antenna itself, provided that it's not, you know, very near the ground. But a couple of feet off the ground, as Rich was saying before, is perfectly fine. Mount it horizontally, and you got an NVIS antenna. Okay? Well, I had to straighten that out because I heard a lot of things that didn't quite sound right to me the way it was discussed before. Back to Ned. WY2U.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, that kind of jives with me. We will have a disagreement about one aspect, and it's sort of the same disagreement I had with Dick, may rest in peace, as well, because he kind of said the same thing, that according to the textbook, and I've seen it in the textbook, that the current is a constant over the entire circumference of a magnetic loop, and the voltage potential is constant over the entire circumference of the and of the magnetic loop. I've also seen a whole bunch of YouTubes where people regularly test that and prove that that's completely wrong, that the highest current that they were able to record was at the driven B point where the inductive coupled driven coax feeds in the signal, and the highest voltage potential is at the capacitor, which is why we need such high rated capacitors. And finally, I think with at least the stick, he did remark that it is a kind of a theoretical concept, that as you make the circumference of the magnetic loop shorter and shorter, it comes closer and closer to that constant value, so that it fully attains that constant value when the circumference of your magnetic loop is 0 feet is less, which is, again, I think more of a theoretical construct than a practical one.
Okay, I didn't say constant, Roy. I think you are assuming that I used the word constant. I said more or less uniform. I have done measurements using a small current pickup transformer at RF, and I've also modeled them with EasyNet. If the loop diameter is much less than, let's say, a tenth of a wavelength or less, the current across the loop varies less than about plus or minus 20%, which is, you know, about a dB and a half. Okay, so it's not constant, but it's, you know, more or less uniform. The comment you made about voltage, though, I don't agree with. The voltage across the capacitor itself, or where the capacitor attaches to the open end of the loop, is the high voltage point. As you go and traverse around the loop, nothing says that voltage has to be constant. In other words, if you take it halfway around the inductor and try to measure it to some kind of a reference that you call ground, it will not be the same voltage. I say nothing about the voltage. I'm talking about the current being more or less uniform. The voltage can change with orientation around the loop, so I agree with you there. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I don't want a semantic argument. The problem I have is the more or the less type of thing. I think most people will kind of shorthand that in their head to pretty much the same, as opposed to not quite, but nearby it type of a thing. So I would phrase things a little bit different, but I understand your side of inserting the more or less factor into it.
I got a question, WHCDM.
Let me just comment to Roy, and Roy can pick you up. Okay, I'll rephrase it. Again, if the loop is less than a tenth of a wavelength in diameter, I have measured less than plus or minus 20% of variation in current, 1.5 dB. More or less probably can be taken in different ways, the way different people interpret it. So if you allow me to say less than a tenth of a wavelength, 20%, then I'll agree with you.
That's perfectly fine. We're in total agreement. You just have to kind of make these numbers real, kind of precise to me at least. Because I am sure I have read many places where they kind of slice off the more or less and just go for the constant current. But okay, well, that's fine with me. I like the wording. So we agree to agree. Andy, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, because I've been listening in the background while doing some extra work. Good evening, Mike. Mike, not to take anything away from Roy, because Roy is very knowledgeable on the subject of loops, but I'm not. Although I've used loops in transmitter direction finding, and I have some interesting thoughts on the different types of loops that I built many years ago and the way they work. But one question I have is, given a certain diameter, and this is whatever the diameter is, in a loop that has a capacitor in the center where it's split, what is the nominal impedance of this particular of any loop antenna? And the reason why I'm saying that is we know that a dipole in free space, a half-wave dipole, has a 72 ohm impedance. What's the nominal impedance of a loop antenna, just like hanging in free space, given its diameter, whatever it is? Is there an actual impedance that could be measured?
I'll take it if you want, Roy.
Yeah, sure, please.
Well, unfortunately there, Andy, it is not you said nominal. There is no nominal value. It really depends on the geometry dimensions of the loop. The impedance of the loop, I think you just, I can sum it up in terms of two impedances. The actual impedance of the loop itself, you want to call that radiation resistance at resonance, that's fine. Assuming you're resonant with a capacitance in series with the loop, it's a resonant circuit and you're left with only resistance. But you have a second term, which is loss, and let's couple that as resistance also. So if you want to talk about the resonant impedance of a loop, which depends on the diameter of the conductor itself, it's going to be approximately equal to the radiation resistance plus the loss resistance. Now, it will probably never be close to 50 ohms like you'd like, unfortunately. So you need to do a coupling arrangement, usually a gamma match type of an arrangement, or some people like to use the small coupling loop, where you take the energy, you make it act like a transformer. You're coupling energy from a 50-ohm system with the right diameter coupling loop and the right spacing to the main loop so that impedance, radiation resistance plus loss resistance, gets transformed to the impedance that the transmitter and coax like, namely 50 ohms. But I can't say that there's going to be a nominal impedance for the loop because it depends, as I said, on a lot of different factors. Andy, back to you.
Okay, I got that 100%. And I was just reading up on that recently, I concur because the book that I was reading on loop antennas stated that same statement regarding the radiation resistance and the loss resistance having an effect on the loop itself. I'm assuming also when you say a loop is horizontally mounted as opposed to vertically mounted, I would think that in the horizontal plane of the loop, it is parallel to the ground as opposed to perpendicular to the ground, which would be in the vertical plane. Am I right in saying it that way?
No, start in free space. Let's put a loop in free space nowhere near ground. It's going to radiate better broadside to the loop. Because think about that. It's bidirectional broadside to the loop, okay? But now you're going to put the loop close to a mirror, the mirror being ground. So that any radiation that normally would have gone from the back of the antenna into the earth is going to get re-reflected back up and become an NVIS antenna. The only difference between the performance of a loop antenna versus the performance of a dipole antenna at low height is that the dipole will have directional effects because of the fact that the dipole doesn't radiate so well off the end. Whereas the loop, since the current is, I'll use that word again, Roy, sorry, since the current in the loop is relatively constant and uniform, it radiates as a sphere. So it's going to be mostly NVIS, but omnidirectionally so, not like a dipole. You get that, Andy? Go ahead.
Yep, I got it, absolutely. Okay. I was just wanted to just get your opinion on the clarification that I had. I have two different loops that I built for 10-meter transmitter hunting that I used to do back in the 70s, and I actually still do, but was much more active. And I have a loop that I built out of an article in QST. It was called a nodal. I'm not sure if I'm spelling it right, N-O-D-A-L or E-L. I gotta look that up again. Where I just simply took an SO239 connector, and I took one turn, one piece of quarter-inch copper tubing, and I flattened it out on both ends, and I forget what the actual diameter is. I think it's maybe a foot and a half or so. And then I went from the ground side of the SO239 to the hot side of that connector. And I put a little trimmer capacitor across it, which helps in improving the gain of the signal from the loop antenna. What's interesting about this loop, as opposed to the ones we're talking about, there is no null in the center of the loop. I actually was able to see a peak, and it was very consistent. The peak was broadside to the loop, just like you're saying, on the hot side, or the center pin side of the SO239, and if you turn the loop 180 degrees in the opposite direction, I would get not a null, but just a decrease in signal strength. So it wasn't a null through the loop. It was a peak on one side. I'm not going to call it a dip, but there was only one peak. And that loop was very accurate and always gave me a good direction because it was not bidirectional. Just to let you know, and that was that was this kind of design instead of using a split type with a capacitor in the center. Back to you, Mike.
Yeah, Andy, I'm speculating, but I believe the reason why you saw this sort of unidirectional effect probably was because you didn't use a balancing device at the feed point. It was just directly connected to the coax. So there was probably some pickup and line radiation emanating down the shield of the coax. And there was since you put a capacitor in the near field of the loop, probably maybe slightly favoring one side of the loop to the other, you may have had some directionality effects there also. I'm speculating, but it sounds like it's something like that. Hey, Roy, by the way, I wrote an Excel spreadsheet years ago. If your offer still stands where I can take a couple of files and load them onto your server, Anybody who wants it, I could make this Excel spreadsheet. It'll design a loop for you any frequency, as long as you put in parameters like the frequency you want to use it at, the diameter of the loop, the diameter of the conductor. It'll calculate the optimal diameter of the secondary loop. And anybody who's interested can have it free of charge. If you can put it on your webpage there, right? WY2U, back to you.
AC2GS. There's a similar site. It's called 66pacific.com, but I'd be more than happy to host your spreadsheet. I think it would be a valuable resource. I just want to touch on and comment on the unidirectionality of magnetic loops. It is my understanding that if the driving or the matching elements are asymmetrical in any way, they tend to favor one side. This is kind of documented repeatedly when I read about magnetic loops, that rather than using a symmetrical inductive driver, they use a gamma mat, which is not symmetrical. It tends to favor one side of the mag loop and turn it from a bidirectional into a unidirectional. And as you mentioned, also anything that would operate as a counterpoise or a radial will disrupt the radiation angles and such, and add a certain directionality. So, you commented about maybe the transmission line is operating as some kind of radial. But, you know, also it could be the asymmetry of whatever driving that particular loop.
Yeah, could be. The way he placed the tuning capacitor, it may have favored one side or the other, which is exactly what you're alluding to, which upsets the current balance in the loop, of course, and now that once you do that, you make a non-symmetrical radiation pattern. But in Andy's case, that was a good thing, because once he found out which way it was going, he was able to use that as an application, which allowed him to pretty accurately determine more or less what the angle of arrival for the transmitter was on a direction-finding system. So that it worked out well in his case. Yeah, it's an Excel spreadsheet, right? It's available. I can email it to you. And the difference between this spreadsheet and a couple of the ones that I've seen online, and I think one of the ones that you described is one of the ones I investigated, too. They do not include losses in the capacitor based on capacitor Q. They just give you more or less a theoretical evaluation of the loop as a loop, and they assume the capacitor is an ideal circuit element, which is very, very far from the truth. I allow you to put in the Q for a capacitor, and once you do that, it changes the efficiency of the loop, sometimes very dramatically. So that's the basic difference, I think, between the Excel spreadsheet that I did versus some of the other ones online that I found. Back to you, Ray.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich recognized. We'll get to you in a second, Rich. Mike, like I said, I probably have to clear it with the actual systems administrator of the website, but he let me put in the radiation hazard spreadsheet a few years ago that you offered me, so most likely he'll be okay with it. So send it to my email address, and I'll try and get it put on that website. And I'll put a link to it on next week's link page. Rich, you want to say something?
Yeah, Mike, how is the Q of the capacitor discerned?
Well, either you have to know it, either by measurement or if the manufacturer specifies it as a function of frequency. I have done measurements, so I'm going to take the burden on myself. I have three types of capacitors that are candidates for the loop. One is a vacuum variable, which has the highest Q, by the way. And I actually give a curve for what you expect for Q based on measurements I made on an RX meter of a variable capacitor, vacuum variable capacitor versus frequency. I also have a butterfly capacitor, which I've done measurements on, and I also have measurements on a standard, what you call your basic single stator tuning capacitor. So whatever capacitor you have, as long as you know the value, you line it up on my chart on frequency, and it gives you an estimate for what the Q is. And that Q value then is allowed to go into the calculations and modifies the actual performance of the loop. Rich, back to you.
Oh, that's great, Mike. I can't wait to get my hands on it. Back to Nick.
Oh, and by the way, Roy, it's not a link. It's just an Excel spreadsheet.
I realize that. I'm saying that if you give me the Excel sheet, I will post it on a page, and then I will give people the link to go to the page on my link page so that they'll know how to get to it.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you misunderstood me, because the other thing I wrote was in JavaScript. It's a web page itself, kind of by itself. All right, no problem, Lou. Roy, I will send it to you, and if it's not allowed, well, so be it. If so, anybody who wants it can certainly make use of it if they find it to be a useful tool. Okay, back to that. WY to you.
Okay, I just want to clear one thing up with you, Mike. This is just an Excel spreadsheet that you download and you run locally and you get the answers, or is it capable of living on a web page and being kind of a live web calculation page?
Well, it's a local application. Anybody who has Excel or an Excel-like program on their computer can take it off your page, copy and paste it to the desktop, and they now have it resident on their own computer if they want it.
Okay, so I'll just put it up someplace that can be downloaded, and I'll offer the download link on my link page. That's probably the easiest approach.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah, that sounds like it'll work. Anybody, again, who has Excel or one of those Excel work-alikes, it's generic enough. It should run on anything in your office or whatever the office work-alike is. I forget the name of it. But I've tried it on both, and it seems to work fine.
Okay, yeah. I mean, Google has a Office group of software compatible with Excel, and the Linux people, of course, have their open-source version of Office products. So, okay, so you send it to me, and I'll upload it to the cloud and offer the link in next week's link page. People can download it to their heart's content.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, excellent, Roy. Thanks a lot.
Yes?
Yeah, good evening, Roy. How are you? WY to you, I think I don't know the gentleman's name. Have you used the term NVIS before? What does that mean?
It means near vertical incident sky wave. It's a fancy way of saying that your RF goes straight up and either bounces back down right to you, not going very far, or goes to outer space. It's excellent if you are in the valley with a bunch of hills around you and you want to contact people locally. It's terrible if you want to contact people very, very far away.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Any other comments on this particular topic?
KGWR. Yeah, I think it's a bit late. Is this a transmitting antenna or just receiving that we're talking about?
David, recognize. We'll get to you in a moment, David. Frank, it's a transmitting. I believe that most of what we've been talking about are transmitting magnetic loops. I did own a receiving magnetic loop. It was not tunable. It had a fixed tune and had a low noise, high gain amplifier, and it was a decent ground antenna. It was not as good as any antenna I could put up on my roof, so I kind of stopped using it. But all the conversations that we've been having tonight are based upon transmitting magnetic loops.
Oh, okay, and I gather this is essentially an NVIS antenna. Okay, thanks a lot. This is one of the hands in the condos in putting up one of these, so they'll get the info for them. Thanks a lot, UB2BXL.
You're welcome, Frank. David, what do you want to say?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. I have a question about certain things I'm able to transmit with 50 watts to Middle Island repeater, and you know, I'm able to access the repeater. So it's very minimal audio, mostly noise, but I kind of feel I can make it on certain days, other days not. I believe it's around 57 to 60 miles away from here. What do you have to say for that? Go ahead.
Well, I have not used that repeater, so I don't have any in-person experience. Propagation is a fickle thing. Tonight, I had to rev up my transmitter to full power because I was not full quieting at the usual strength. So propagation does affect even ground wave propagation, point-to-point reception. What is causing it in the case of this particular repeater that you're using, I do not know, but it certainly is a reality. You're not imagining it.
Well, from what I hear, the antenna's pretty high. Over 500 feet above the ground. I struggle. I'm not able to reach Belden, though I haven't really tried, but I can reach Middle Island. So I guess part of it is if it's from point to point, you know, line of sight, transmission, and maybe 57 miles is a possibility, or UHF, right?
Yeah, it certainly is a possibility. You have to understand that they're not lined up identically, so there are different structures that your radio waves are bouncing off and reflecting and going every which way in a different way than the two repeaters, and the Zeldin is, I believe, farther away from you than the Middle Island one. So all those things kind of come together and produce propagation. But it's not a fixed situation. It's not 100%. Unfortunately, just altitude, location, and line of sight contact. There are other little things. Weather conditions can have an effect. Wind conditions can have an effect. There's always the possibility of receiver desensing from local transmitted signals that you know, we're unaware of because they're not on frequency, but they're enough in effect to desense the receiver and cause an increase in background noise. So things are changeable, but, you know, if you can get through, it means that in some cases propagation is acceptable and you can get through.
Thank you, Roy. Yeah, I transmit on 449.075 in the Delta, and I tripped the Glen Oaks repeater. I have a what do they call it? A half duplex transceiver, Kenwood TMB71A. So Middle Island is on one side, and Glen Oaks is on the other.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, as long as you're able to get on. I can't get into Zeldin, and I haven't tried Middle Island. I'm happy that I'm able to get into Glen Oaks. There have been some nights here where, for whatever reason, my radio just couldn't capture Glen Oaks, and I had to go through Echo Link, and everyone was quick keying, which really should quick key the guy who's the net control operator. But yeah, if you can get through, then that's good.
Oh, Roy, why don't you try All Starlink? Get a computer, Windows 10. You get some kind of off speed browser like Tail Moon, and you
you open the browser to All-Star Web Link Transceivers, and you tune in. All you need is an old computer and a microphone. Go ahead.
Well, AC2GS, by the way, in my mind, it's not that much different than Echo Link. I already have Echo Link configured, so it's not a problem. I am an Echo Link node for another club, the County Radio Club. The Echo node is KC2RC-R, so I'm already running Echo Link because I'm the node. So it's easier that way. I have so many things running. You know, anyone can go to my QRZ page and take a look at the picture, and one of the pictures is the screen is up during, I think, one of my science talks, portions of the technical net. I'm looking at 15 different windows. I'm looking at all kinds of things. So to have yet a 16th window does not strike me as a good idea, at least for me. And by the way, for people out there from the last conversation, John KB2BD, who is in our chat room, reminds me that it's called LibreOffice, is the Linux-style open-source Office suite that a lot of people use. But anyway, I understand, and I've heard about All-Star, and I've read about All-Star. I have hotspots, I have screens, I have soundboards, I have way too much electronics in the shack as it is.
QSL. But there's one big advantage for All-Star. Even if you get the limited access, which doesn't cost anything, the audio is really good, you know. If you're like using an HT and a what do they call that? Like a five star? You know, the quality of the audio is quite good. If you look at, I think Middle Island is linked to one or two of the other repeaters using All Star and not IRLP. So go figure that.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Unfortunately, that has changed the nature of Echo Link windows. In the old days, if you pulled up, and I'm sure you've noticed it, if you pull up the Echo Link window in the old days, it gave the people who were logged on to that node their call sign. Now, instead of their call sign, because it's routed through All-Star, it gives the Echo Link node numbers, which are unique six-digit identifiers, which almost no one memorizes. So I ordinarily wouldn't have a clue who was logged on to Echo Link without a translation program available. So, yeah, I understand All-Star is a thing, and there are some people who are very enthusiastic about All-Star. And at this point, I'm hoping that I can stick with my radio contact. I like radio, and I would prefer, all things being equal, to be able to contact and interact with everyone using RF as opposed to voice over IP. If I need it, I need it, but if I can get away without it, I would prefer that.
USL boy, and with your RF, of course I like RF, a couple of batteries, power goes out or the internet goes, you can make some emergency communication.
Well, theoretically, if my personal power goes out, and my cell tower doesn't go out, I can pick up my cell phone and use my Echo Link application.
There's no internet, no electricity, we can go on battery.
Yes, indeed, we can go on battery. By the way, I don't know what's going on. If your battery on your radio is going down, your signal noise is going up. You know, it started at around 20-30%. Now it's about 80%. So I'm not quite sure what's causing that. I do have a lithium iron phosphate battery, a big capacity hunker, and an emergency bypass sensing switching system, Power Epic, I believe it's called, so that if my utility power goes out, my ICOM 7100 switches over to the battery, and I'm still on the air. So I agree with you. It's a good idea to have battery power as backup. Also, that same device will triple charge the battery when power is available through utility, so it's always kept at a full charge. So I'm prepared at least in that way.
Coming from your end also, what is happening with I'm going to exit this conversation. I just want to say that no matter what happens, you know, we've all feel the ACTPS R1.
Okay, I hope I'm not quite that noisy out there. Next on our list for tonight is Jim, KD2VHC. What's your topic, question, or comment for tonight, Jim?
This is Jim, KD2VHD. I've been having some progress building my 160-meter dipole, and I wound my transformer, my balance, and I think I did the wrong version. So I wanted to throw it out and see if I get some feedback. I have a Type 31 toroid, 17 turns, half one way, half the other, of RG58 coax around. And I think I've come to understand that that is a, while that's a good common mode choke, it doesn't actually eliminate the common mode. It just keeps it off the feed line. And I would be better off winding the coil with, I think the term is bifiller, in other words, two individual wires wrapped in a certain pattern on that toroid to eliminate the production of the common mode current rather than trying to just stop it from coming back on the feed line. I don't know if I'm using the language correctly, but over to you, Roy, and the feedback.
Sure, you're using the terminology well. What you're really talking about is a balance, one-to-one balance. Is sometimes also RF chokes are given the name one-to-one balance. Although they're not exactly one-to-one transformer balance because there's no transformation or no even uniform transformation. What you're describing with the multi-filament windings is the primary and the secondary. If your primary windings are the same as the secondary windings, you have the same impedance in both of them, so it doesn't transform the impedance, so it's a one-to-one, and it also blocks common mode current. So you're right in that way, except that ultimately if you impede the common mode sufficiently enough at the feed point, it's a rather academic analysis. Ultimately, you got the same thing. It's all right to have the concept of a common mode reflection if you're going to introduce a high impedance block at the point of the feed point. Where it breaks down is if you put that that RF scope further down your transmission line. At that point, that length of on-RF scope transmission line is operating in common mode. It can radiate and act as a portion of the antenna and detune your frequency of your antenna. So if you place your RF scope at the feed point, it should be at
I believe I understand, but further research seems to be pointing to the possibility, if I'm understanding it correctly, that the coax wound around the toroid plate at the feed point, like you said, blocks the common mode from coming back. Yeah, but if you did it in the tool, micellar, I believe they call it, that style wrapping, it actually better balances what's happening on the antenna itself, and it creates less common mode. So you don't need to block it as much. In other words, it stops it at the creation rather than at the feed point. Am I understanding that correctly?
Again, I guess it could be interpreted that way. The point, though, is that these common mode currents are generated at the antenna feed point. So the difference between, say, having an RF choke, if you put the RF choke or the one-to-one transformer ballast at the same distance from the transmission line, you still have the same situation. You have not stopped the creation of common mode, you've blocked it. So unless you were somehow to design the ballast circuit inside the actual antenna, I can't see how you wouldn't get common mode for at least a minuscule length from the feed point to the site of your new one-to-one transformer ballast, right?
I suppose the way I was perceiving it, and I guess maybe that's the heart of the question, is that if I was to feed the balance dipole with coax, oversimplification is that the center conductor is being one leg, happily, and the supposedly neutral shield is feeding the other leg. And it's a one-legged man. It's really... It's not equally giving signal to both ends of the dipole. And if I understand it correctly, if you do the one-to-one balance correctly, it changes that so that the complementary signal going from one leg and the other leg, and it makes a smooth waveform, half on one leg and half on the other. I don't think that's explained exactly right, but you get my point.
Okay, so theoretically, if you were to take this one-to-one transformer ballast and place it directly at the feed point, not an inch away, you know, have a little bit of a transmission line and before it gets to it, I guess you could make the case that it'll provide a balanced signal for the antenna, which will limit the amount of common mode reflection. But again, theoretically, if you place the RF choke close enough to the feed point for all intent purposes, you've pretty much got the same thing in my mind. I'll ask for the audience's opinion, because I value that. In addition, I'd like to point out, unfortunately or fortunately, coax cables are kind of three-legged nets. They have three conductors, basically. One is the center. Most of the RF travels at the outer skin of the center wire. Then there's two other places where RF travels. In differential mode, the one that we all want to have, the other current is running on the inner aspect of the outer shield. The reflection, the common mode reflection coming back, is traveling on the outer aspect of the outer shield. So there are three effective conductors in each of our coaxial cables.
Yes, I've been learning about that. It's interesting. I was wondering if, like you said, if there was any other feedback from the group.
Certainly. Anyone out there, if you'd like to say a few words about the additional benefits of using a one-to-one non-transforming balanced transformer versus a just rudimentary RF choke for a center-fed dipole?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
It's a very interesting question. I spoke to a ham out in Texas who seemed to know a lot about this subject, and he said, in his mind, just doing at the feed point of the dipole, 6 or 7 turns of coax, and you know, and in line with, you know, your feed line coax, the same coax, in other words, just a loop of 6 turns, 6 to 12 inches in diameter, is as effective or more effective than a 1-to-1 balance.
Okay, that's his opinion. Now, I know a lot of people with a lot of different opinions, and a lot of people have opinions that they don't particularly. Those are called ugly ballots. Usually, you see them. They run it through punch holes in a can or something, or some wide tubing PVC. What it is basically is an air core inductor. There are people out there, especially people who sell ferrites, who urge people to not use air cores because air cores are not quite as efficient, higher impedance devices as coil with some ferrite. You can either put strap a bunch of ferrite cores in a row, that's the W2DU type of a ballast, or you can get a toroid and run loops around it, and the more loops, the more it keeps. So I've heard that as well. Again, anyone else with any other comments about the preferences of the transformer used for a common mode choking or just a regular high impedance inductor for doing the RF choking?
By the way, Roy, I heard that type 43 is better than type 31 for HF.
It depends what you're using. In my understanding, type 31 is a better all-round. It operates, I think, something like 2 to 3 megs to 100, which is HF. Depends on what you're doing. If you're going to use a transformer ballast, 43 is probably better. It just doesn't saturate as much. So if you're using it as a transformer, there are certain types of mixes that are preferred. If you're using it simply as a ferrite to RF choke, 31s are very, very common. They're sold, they sell a lot of 31s. I own a lot of 31s.
PhD?
Yes, Jim.
My research has seemed to be pointing towards that the 31 is better from 40 meters to 160 meters, and the 43 is better for like. Again, what I seem to have picked up, I can't swear with them. What do you find this?
Yeah, this sort of goes back to a conversation that I had a month or so ago. It has to do with how construction and how ferrite work involves a concept of permeability. The permeability drops below in the middle of the HF. Set for the low end of HF for 31 and 43 for the higher, but if you also factor in that impedance is important, you're blocking the atomic mode impedance at all. It increases as you increase. So you going up attention. For all intents and purposes, using an RF choke for any kind of HF going up to about 10 meters or maybe 6 suffices. I know of no one personally who has a set of 43s for one half of the HF band and 31s for the other.
Oh boy, did you decrease your transmitting power?
No, I did not. It is at full power, unfortunately. I don't know what's going on with the repeater. I don't know how my reception is going, but I'm running at 100% power these days.